Chances are you'll be hearing all sorts of rumors that Jean is planning to leave Benny tomorrow or the day after. The chances are even greater that these rumors won't be true, and that Jean will continue to chew gum in the back of Benny's stand for a while to come.
So wrote the critic George T. Simon in the March 1938 issue of Metronome magazine. As he later admitted, it was his worst ever prediction. The day after these words were published, Gene Krupa did leave Benny Goodman and started his own band, which is the subject of this show. I'm Stuart Copeland, and this is part three of Gene Krupa, Drummin' Man.
Had good players straight off. There was that trumpet player called Corky Cornelius. And that's a really good record because they really get a roll going. I mean, you know, and you can feel that, you know, that sweep, that rhythmic fire that was Gene's trademark.
Broadcaster Jeffrey Smith. Atoning for his mistake, George T. Simon was there at the new Krupa Band's opening night, Easter Sunday, April 16th, 1938, at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City. He was impressed with everything except the sax section, and there he may have had a point. Because if there was one department where the band never really distinguished itself, it was the saxes. But Gene, from the start, showed a good sense of what people liked, and of how to sell all features of his own style, including the one that great modern drummer Ed Shaughnessy especially admires.
I know some folks don't pay attention to his. He played the greatest brushes with the Benny Goodman Trio and Quartet. Boy, did he play the brushes. He got so hot with the brushes. I mean, you wouldn't think you could get that level of intensity going with brushes, but, you know, he had things like single stroke patterns toward the last chorus or two. And boy, it would just knock your socks off, you know?
This translated immediately into one of Gene's new specialties, wire brush stomp. For the first time, the public began to get an idea of Gene as a voice and a person. What people weren't so prepared for was the social awareness that ran alongside Gene's musical energy.
In terms of Gene's attitude towards race, he had some very good black arrangers like Fred Norman and Chappie Willette. Chappie Willette did his theme song, which was called A Perksody, which is Krupa spelled backwards with the last part of Rhapsody. Funny title. But Gene was, he was very hip. He was one of the early established band leaders to catch on to Dizzy. He was a big fan of Dizzy's, and he had ears.
Professor Dan Morgenstern. It wasn't long before Krupa was featuring black players on stage, famously the trumpeter Roy Eldridge, though he wasn't the first.
Before Roy Eldridge, he had the marvelous scat genius Leo Watson in his band, not just on records, but touring with him, which was quite something, you know, to have a black performer with a white band as a regular attraction. Leo was he was somewhat unpredictable. He was kind of like his singing, he was kind of a crazy guy. But he was wonderful, and some of those records are great.
Gene did concede later in life. For the first year or so, he gave too much room to his own solo features, and indeed the drums in general.
He did things like Blue Rhythm Fantasy, where each musician had a tom-tom attached to his stand, and he would give, you know, different beats to the section, and he would give the saxophones a certain rhythm to play on their tom-toms attached to their music stand. He'd give the brass, maybe the trombones another one, the trumpets another one, and he would have some separate percussion with the rhythm guys, and then he would solo over that. And boy, if that's not African, I don't know what it is, because they often play background beats while a lead drummer carries a solo.
Part of the Blue Rhythm Fantasy. So the band became a band rather than a showcase only when a couple of real star names were added. The black trumpeter Roy Eldridge certainly was one, but as broadcaster Jeffrey Smith says, this wasn't a rerun of Benny Goodman situation. Roy never appeared as a kind of add-on novelty.
Benny was the first one to bring black players into his setup, into the Goodman menage. But Gene was the first guy who brought a black player full-time into his trumpet section. And that was really new, because it wasn't just, okay, now we're going to wheel on the trio. He sat up there all the time with everybody else, and that was really something.
And it wasn't easy on Roy.
Jazz writer Gary Gibbons.
I mean, I got to know Roy pretty well, and boy, whenever that subject came up, he got grim. But, you know, he loved Gene. He never said a bad word about Gene in my presence, but it was humiliating. I mean, I remember him saying, you couldn't even walk into the Chinese restaurants. And he would say, you know, talk about how great you are on the bandstand. Everybody's cheering. And then, you know, once you walk off, it's something else entirely.
Roy had kind of a very sensitive membrane for any kind of prejudice. But he said Gene was absolutely 100% clean. And that thing, you know, that was really something that Roy often stressed. How wonderful Gene was in that respect.
So that was very difficult, but it was courageous of Gene to do it. And it was especially courageous the way he did it in terms of teaming Roy with Anita.
Anita O'Day was Gene's new vocalist, a combative lady, a fellow Chicagoan, and white, of course.
I mean, even now, if I'm teaching and I show that clip of Anita and Roy, you know, people are like, wow, how'd they get away with that? Because it's so sexy. You know, and I don't know that they were intending it as to be sexy at the time, but you look at it now and it's, how else do you read it? And so that was a pretty incredible thing to use them together the way he did.
Let Me Off Uptown was a big hit, and that was really big. So that was quite something.
Hey, Joe.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, all you've got to shout is, let me off uptown. In the rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal. All you've got to spill is, let me off. Go to top it if you want to pitch a ball. And you can't afford a hall. All you've got to call is, let me off uptown.
Anita O'Ann.
What's your fear, Roy? The heat?
No, it must be that uptown rhythm. I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy.
Anita and Roy, they had a very strange relationship. On stage and on records, I mean, musically, professionally, it was fine. But personally, there was a lot of tension. And Roy would tell me, you know, that for some reason or other, Anita seemed to be jealous of him, and I think Anita felt the same way about Roy. So they had this strained relationship. But Anita was, you know, she was pretty nutty anyway, as we know.
How can you put Roy? He was a character, right? And he'd always been first wherever he went and whatever. Now he's second to Gene. Now I come on the scene there and we got this new material. Well, I just keep moving. I'm not trying to upstage him. But he went to Gene. He says, hey, the chick is upstaging me. And Gene calls me in the office and says, why are you upstaging Roy? I said, I'm not upstaging Roy. I'm just doing my little dance to keep the thing full. You know, I just do my part. So Gene told him to cool it. Well, every time he got drunk, he'd say, he's upstaging me. And it just got into a ball. It rolled and it rolled and it rolled. It meant absolutely nothing.
Anita was feisty enough to insist that on tour she wouldn't wear the standard party frock of the big band Canary. She would appear in a band jacket, just like all the guys. It was true, by the way, that Roy would get drunk. One of his biggest successes, Rockin' Chair, was allegedly created that way. They'd been recording all day in New York's Liederkranz Hall with Eldridge getting steadily mellower.
And at the end of the thing, he said, well, let's try Rockin' Chair. And I said, well, not now. I mean, you know, because by this time, the date's over. And I always, pace myself. So if I'm blind, the date's through, right? So he tried it once, and it didn't make it. He tried it again. And he said, well, that's okay. So I went up to him and begged him not to put the thing out. And he put it out. I don't know why, but Ben Webster is the one that played it for me. This is like 6-8 weeks later, or longer than that maybe. He invited me to breakfast and he said, I want you to hear a record. So when the introduction started out, I said, wait a minute, who is that? That ain't Louie. And I didn't recognize nothing about that introduction until I got in the chorus and I heard my sound. Now, would you believe it? I didn't know nothing about anything I had played on that record. And for it to turn out that perfect is a miracle.
Thank you.
semi-conscious feature Rocking Chair. Roy was a fine drummer, too, and every so often Krupa would stand out in front and conduct, while Eldridge propelled the band from the drum chair. Later, Gene hired a drummer specially to give him some time out front, conducting. In spite of the temperaments, this was a happy band. Gene himself had relaxed and ceased to overpower the public with sheer percussion. In fact, some of the hits they scored with Anita at the microphone, now and later, were pure pops, played with a light touch.
We had a bunch of tunes out there nobody else was doing. Harriet, and songs like that. All the fellas want to marry Harriet. Harriet's handy with a lariat, but she don't want to marry it. She's having too much, and all the novelties.
Just a little bit south of North Carolina, that's where I long to be. In a little brown shack in South Carolina, someone waits for me. In each letter he says, the weather's fine, the folks are feeling great. The garden looks grand and the red rose vine is clinging to the gate. Just a little bit south of North Carolina, that's where my thoughts all stay. To the one I love best in South Carolina, I'm going back someday. I can hardly wait to see the face of the one I idolize. Just a little bit south of North Carolina, I'll find paradise.
How long could this have gone on, nobody knows. But early in 1943, Gene Krupa suffered a personal catastrophe. The modern belief is that it was no accident. First of all, as Lauren Schoenberg points out, there was a war on.
During the Second World War in the States, you know, there was a lot of suspicion and anger almost directed at some of the popular entertainment figures who were of age to have been drafted or serve in the Army but weren't. I mean, Clark Gable, Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw, and others were in the service, and others like Sinatra weren't, and Krupa wasn't.
Then again, Gene was more controversial in some people's minds than he probably realized.
The whole thing looks like it was a setup, and it was the feds who really got him into this predicament, and I always suspected that it had something to do with resentment in some quarters of his sponsorship of Roy Eldridge, and also maybe his putting Roy and Anita together, which probably rubbed some, you know, racists the wrong way, for sure.
Either way, Gene was famous and handsome and noisy, and available to be brought low.
There you have the downside of crossing over into celebrity land, because they would not have bothered to go after him if he wasn't Gene Krupa. This gave them the attention they wanted. Apparently, you know, they heard that this kid was buying him a band boy was buying him some pot as a sort of going away gift. And the cops went to his dressing room or whatever, and they couldn't find anything. So when they left, Gene called the band kid at the hotel and said, it's in my pocket, throw it away, or flush it down the toilet. And the kid didn't do that. He left the hotel with it, and the cops stopped him, and they tied that to Gene.
So the first charge, pretty tenuous anyway, was possession. But the story gets more complicated because the band boy Gene called at the hotel, the one found carrying Gene's jacket with the funny cigarette inside, was not the original band boy, but his replacement, who was much younger.
The kid was underage, so he got busted for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And he fought the charge, but, you know, was convicted and served, well, Gene always said 94 days. I mean, if that's what he thought.
But he actually spent, I think, 2 months or maybe a little more at San Quentin. You know, that's hard time. And for what? Basically for two joints that were in this jacket. And, you know, marijuana was legal in most of the United States until 1936. So it was just a ridiculous trumped up charge. And unfortunately, it was so played up that he had to live with that for the rest of his life.
He certainly did the time. But finally, you know, he appealed and all charges were dropped. But it was a terrible thing because it really briefly put paid to his career.
Gene Krupa's band had gone, many friends had gone, and most of his money had gone on legal fees. As he came out of jail, he was met by his recently divorced ex-wife, Ethel. In better times, they remarried. But at that moment, Krupa was crushed. For longer than was comfortable, he did nothing much, just retreated into study and practice. It was a call from Benny Goodman that brought him back to active life.
Benny, even before he hired him, when Gene was still under a cloud. He said, he's a wonderful guy and a wonderful drummer anywhere, any place, any time. He wants his old job back. It's his. Which was kind of nice and not the kind of thing that we usually associate with Benny.
And then Benny did hire him. It was never going to last for long, but it was a vital bridge back to reality. It wasn't long before Gene slipped away and joined Tommy Dorsey's band, still unsure how the public was taking to him.
And there's a wonderful story that I've read that, when they were about, maybe it was the Paramount Theater, one of those big theater gigs where the band comes up, from down below and rises up. And Krupa was really nervous about the reaction and the reception that he would get from the audience after having been jailed on these marijuana charges. And I guess he was kind of sweating, and the band came up and supposedly, the place just went berserk. And Krupa was back, and he never looked back.
It's true. Ed Shaughnessy was there.
Yeah, well, the stage would rise, and when the lights went on and the audience saw Gene Krupa playing with Tommy Dorsey, the place went crazy. I mean, absolutely nuts. And, of course, he played a piece later. Tommy gave him a spot, and I thought it was very generous of Tommy to do that. And when I played with Dorsey some years later, I told him that. He said, well, I think Gene needed a helping hand at the time. I said, well, you gave him a good one at the time. It really did a lot for him,
That happened to be the Armed Forces V-Disc session from Carnegie Hall with Dorsey and Krupa together on TD Chant, the old Hawaiian war chant.
I thought that was important that, a couple of the most popular musicians in the country immediately embraced him and sort of put their arm around him and said, he's okay. And then, eventually he did put together the second band, which made some good records. And, he had that thing with the strings. I don't know what that was about.
Krupa's Band That Swings With Strings was directly inspired by Tommy Dorsey's experiments with a string section. It, too, was destined not to last, but some famous recordings came out of it.
Leave Us Sleep. That's great jazz drumming. It swings, the breaks are fantastic, they're tasteful. The whole thing is so well organized. And I've always felt that Gene's whole reputation, his whole posthumous career, as well as the career that he endured after the middle 1940s, was very misguided. I remember getting angered by a lot of the obituaries because it was all about the drug bust, which, concerned two joints of marijuana, and the flashiness. Everybody talked about Sing, Sing, Sing when they should have been talking about that amazing band that he put together with Roy Eldridge and Anita O'Day and all those great arrangers and players.
Well, we'll see next time how Gene Krupa survived in the world of modern jazz and how his reputation really should stand in our own time. I'm Stuart Copeland, and this is Gene Krupa, Drummin' Man, a Ping production for Radio 2, written by Russell Davis and produced by Graham Pass.